The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So case 16 from the Book of Serenity. Magu shakes his staff, pointing to a deer, making it out to be a horse, picking up earth and turning it to gold, rousing wind and thunder on the tongue, hiding a bloody sword between the eyebrows, sitting there watching success and failure, standing there examining death and life. Tell me, what state is this? The case. Magu, ringed staff in hand, came to Zhangqing. He circled the meditation seat three times, shook his staff once, and stood there at attention. Zhangqing said, "Right, right." Magu also went to Nanchuan, circled the meditation seat three times, shook his staff, and stood there at attention. Nanchuan said, "Wrong, wrong." Magu said, "Zhangqing said right. Why do you say wrong?" Nanchuan said, "Zhangqing is right. It's you who's wrong. This is something that can be blown by the power of the wind. It inevitably disintegrates." The verse. Right and wrong. Watch out for the trap. Seeming to put down, seeming to uphold. It's hard to tell who is the elder brother, who the younger. Conceding, he adapts to the time. Denying, what's special to me? One shake of the metal staff, standing out all alone, three times around the seat, a leisurely romp. The monastery's agitated. Right and wrong are born. It seems like they are seeing ghosts in front of their skulls. It's a beautiful day. The sun shining, the window open. Really something, the snow melting. Tiny flowers appearing. Some sort of mystery. This mystery of birth. How a thing comes to be. How right and wrong come to be. We read in our chants earlier that we just need to set our preferences aside. And of course, this is actually a really important teaching. So often caught by our ideas of right and wrong. And our ideas of right and wrong can lead us to cause great harm. Undoubtedly, those who do great harm think they are doing something right. So certain of what they are doing. So right that they are superior. So right that harming others is okay because they are so wrong. And this is how so many tragedies unfold. We are all on some level touched by the tragedies of the world, touched by shootings. Shootings across the world ring through our own hearts and break us open. And we grieve and we get angry and we are hurt. The harm done is incalculable. And, of course, a time for right and wrong. We have our two teachers, each offering the Dharma. One embodying, yes, right, right. Thump, chang, right, right. And one saying, no, wrong. This isn't some trick you play. This isn't some dance you get to do. This is a matter of life and death. Each offering a view of right and wrong. Both views to be blown away by time. This profound teaching of life and death, birth and death, how a thing comes to be, how a thing passes away. And so often the challenge in practice is flowing with things as they are, in a way aligning with what is. So many sticky points. Oh, I shouldn't be thinking right and wrong, and so we try to suppress, and then right and wrong appear. And then we're touched by some horror. We say, that's so wrong. It strikes me as unfitting in some way to try to reject that sense of right and wrong. And it also is a trap when we get stuck in them. Or when we hold on to them longer than is called for. Where we reside in certainty. Where we make ourselves superior or aim to punish. So this life is not a fixed position. It would be nice if it were. It would make things so simple for us in our practice. Just tell me not to think right and wrong and I'm cool. You know, or just tell me it's right and I'm good. Tell me it's wrong. It's fine. One of those. Stick with it. Sometimes it's right. Sometimes it's wrong.
So sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. Living in this world of coming and going, trying to realize the Tathagata's true meaning. The Tathagata is another name for the Buddha. He did not call himself the Buddha. Buddha simply means someone who is awake. So, of course, we are all Buddhas. Maybe we are all baby Buddhas. And we appear in all of the forms of the universe. Uchiyama Roshi, a 20th century Japanese Zen teacher, says everything you encounter is your life. Everything you encounter is your life. And certainly some things we encounter we like. And some things we encounter we don't like. Some things we encounter we love. That place where joy rises in the heart. And some places we encounter the heart closes down. The heart says, I refuse to be here. I'm going out for a cigarette break. Enough of this life and death. I will not tolerate this anymore. And yet, it doesn't go away. And at some point, the great walls we have constructed begin to crumble, and we try to hold them up. Here on retreat, walls we didn't even know we had become apparent. We encounter the good and the bad. We encounter this life. And we are encouraged in Zen to encounter this life in the particular. Zen philosophy is wonderful, and many of us like reading Zen philosophy. But the actual practice of Zen is not a philosophy, is not even a religion. With these 4 points, and remembering these 4 points, you're okay. You're not okay. There is not a position you can hold where you are okay. And there is not a position where you're not okay. But we enter into okay position, we enter into not okay position, and the teaching of Zen that in the particular, in this yes, in this no, in this right, in this wrong, everything is revealed. So in some way we're not even trying to get beyond right and wrong. We are not trying to transcend something so that we're no longer touched by it. But rather we are learning how to move directly into the thing itself. And when we move directly into the thing itself is us, ourself. And in this meeting, everything is just as it should be. This meeting with the great heartbreak, this meeting with the great joy. And we find not that there is no wall to tear down. As Alan said so beautifully last night, these mind objects of yes and no, of clutter and space, as we get familiar with them, there begins to be a kind of transparency. And we see that each particular thing is life itself. And that in each particular thing is not separate from us. And this moving through, leaping through the many and the one, Dogen says. Leaping through this particular moment, entering deeply, thoroughly in this moment, we are totally cooked. Right? Perfectly, perfectio, perfectly done. Burned to a crisp. Underdone, not enough time. Each state, wherever you are, wherever you imagine you are on this imaginary road you have created, you are at home. All of us hobos, all of us with coffee grounds pasted to our face, all of our eyes shining as we go from house to house, please give me alms. And not an apple. Give me a Snickers bar or something good with sugar in it. I don't want a health treat, thank you. All of us here. All of us slowly coming apart as this wind blows through us. Everything falls apart. And we find we have always been at home, right and wrong.
It's really interesting to go third. I listened to Mike Sensei and the wisdom pouring out of his toes. and I get inspired and I think, oh, I want to pick up that thread when it's my turn. And then another thing, and then another thing, and then another thing. And where did all those threads go? And then David Roshi begins speaking and, oh my goodness, I could talk about this, that, the other thing. Where did they go? The certainties about picking up the Dharma in this particular form. One of the treats of the trio Teisho is that you can do the same thing that I've been doing. A thread, something in these words touches you and you go, oh, and then something else happens and you can't remember what that oh came from. The weather today is very unusual, in my opinion. The ground is covered with snow. And yet, some places are beginning to reveal the snowdrops poking up from the earth. And the wind is very strong. And it's moving the trees that surround the temple. And the air is strangely warm. How could all these things coexist? The world is full of so many things. I'm sure we should all be as happy as kings, as Robert Louis Stevenson said in my first book of poetry when I was 5 years old. My parents gave it to me. And the fulfillment of that is what's been happening all my life. As I encounter the Dharma in all its forms, as I encounter the world, because the Dharma is even too much of a word to place on it, just the many manifestations of form, all revealing the awakened heart, all revealing themselves as gates to opening, awakening. And the koan, the last line that David Caruso was so touched by yesterday, which we read in two different translations. I'll read them both. This is something that can be blown by the power of the wind. It inevitably disintegrates. And your action is the movement of the wind. In the end, it will perish. So we see it in small ways, the thoughts, the inspirations, the awakenings. Especially at a sashin, you know, somebody serves you soup and the whole world lights up. somebody shoves in front of you in the keen line, and your heart just melts with relief at the way we're all together, you know, whatever, you know what they're like. And then the mind comes in, because we all have them. Some are big and some are little, and some last for a little longer and some diminish, but they're all blown away. Ultimately, none of us will keep this moment of presence. It's not ours to keep. It's not why we're here. This recognition of our interconnection, this recognition of pervading throughout time and space, this is not personal, as we've been saying. In 200 years, none of us will be here. Who knows what will be left of the earth? We don't know. A flourishing ecosystem with joyful, happy people singing and dancing and picking flowers. That could be what's happening in 200 years. Or you could watch a lot of TV and have a different idea about what it's going to be like in 200 years. Not really relevant, and yet we are those people also 200 years from now. We have a responsibility to them. We are the people who died in New Zealand yesterday, and not just New Zealand, you know that, right? People have died horrible deaths within the last 24 hours everywhere on the planet. Everywhere. Most of them unheralded. And people have been born, and people have found each other and fallen in love, and all kinds of great stuff's been happening. All of it connected. All of it will perish, and yet all of it is permanent. I think of Magu fanning himself and the student coming up and saying, what's going on? I thought nothing was permanent. I thought the Dharma was always present, and we don't have to do anything because we're already awake. What's the big deal here? And the mature, the old Magu, fans himself and says, you don't understand the nature of the wind. Fanning himself, right? Why do you have to fan yourself if the wind permeates everywhere? Why do we have to attend Sesshin if we're already awakened Buddhas? Why do we have to practice if we're already okay? And David says, and we're not okay. And so I moved to remember a moment from last fall when David and I were, well, maybe I was, and David went along with it. We were trying to do the right thing at Halloween. And we knew apples were a bad idea because, you know, they just get thrown out because they probably have razor blades in them and all that stuff. So I had the brilliant idea, which was really helped by the good folks at CVS Pharmacy, to buy a big bag of little tiny bags of potato chips. And I brought them home and I thought, you know, at least there's no sugar in them. You know, there's tons of carbohydrates and salt and oil, but this will be great. And of course, you know, all the little hobos and princesses and whatever Marvel Comics is presenting right now, who came to the door, received them and said, thank you. And one little boy, I put the potato chip in his, the bag of potato chips in his Halloween bag, and he looked at me, his eyes shining, and he looked at his parents and he said, Mommy, Daddy, potato chips! Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. We're lifting the guideline for eye contact and speaking, and also remember we're recording this, so if you don't want your comments or questions recorded, just let us know and we'll shut off the recorder.
Just want to share how in the last few hours, starting with the last session yesterday, so much started making sense that didn't make sense before. The simplicity of breathing. It had never been so abundant. It had never been so clear that it is not a thought. That even though many thoughts are very pleasant and they feel like real breakthroughs, they don't compare with the simplicity of just breathing. And as I was listening to the talk today, the thread that stayed with me, even though I did forget many of them as a new one came, was about joy. It was about when the soul merges with what it wants, it becomes joyful. And when what it wants is outside, you didn't have control of it. With that, when what you want is inside of you, it's just breathing. It's so, there's nothing closer to you than just breathing. No one can, as long as you're alive, there's nothing that can happen that can take that away. And if what you desire is just breathing, merging with what you desire is so easy.
Thank you. I really appreciate you talking about these moments when we see how simple it is. I think one of the problems is there's all this talking and we've read all this stuff and we think there's something quite complicated called Zen Buddhism and meditation and we're going to figure it out. So we try and we make it quite complex. And on retreat, we get exhausted or we get so overcomplex our circuit starts frying or sometimes we get a glimpse. And for me too, oh, just breathe. Right. And I think when that really hits us, when we have an experience of it, it's a revelation. You know, like, why didn't they tell me? And then, as you say, we say inside and outside, we imagine there's something out there and something in here. But in this moment of breath, there is no inside or outside. There is, everything is complete. Yeah. Thank you. So I want to encourage, especially noticing some of us are prone to move forward and some to move back. So if you're a moving back person, would encourage you, if it's possible, if it makes sense, to come forward. Sometimes you can raise your hand without even knowing what you're going to say, and then you get called on, and a little bit like Doksan. the wisdom in this room comes through each one of us, and the comparing mind, as Melissa said yesterday, can be, well, that person's so articulate, whatever. But just inviting any of you who might not usually speak up to say something. Yeah.
I feel like you've both been, and I know it's not directed specifically to me, but it's been resonating because I know I've been too tired away. I'm struck by kind of the bind that I find myself in when it comes to this practice, when you talk about I feel like the student going to agree with the fan. It's sort of like, okay, well, if we're already awakened, then why do this? And I know I can't just not do this practice, because then, you know, I'd be kind of a mess. So, I don't know. It's a weird situation to be in. And I know that idea of the simplicity of the moment is a nice idea, but I also know if I can grab onto it, then I've just made another kind of delusion to hold on to.
No, it's so important that you're saying this out loud, because I'm sure you're not the only person in the room who feels that way, obviously, because, you know, the guy who came to Magu had that same thing. And, you know, why do you have to fan yourself if the nature of the wind permeates everywhere? I don't get it. What's going on? If I'm already an awakened person, you know, why do I have to do this? What? My legs hurt, for goodness sake. What? You know, wouldn't it be easier to get a massage? What's going on? You know, Dogen also had this same motivation in the 1200s. You know, he heard the teachings. Teachings were prevalent throughout Japan when he was growing up, and he wondered about the meaning of life, and he heard this teaching that everybody's already awake, and it didn't satisfy him. Right, just like the Buddha back in 2600 years ago, he mastered all the esoteric teachings of his day, and nothing satisfied him. And the thing we point to is that you almost have to have that dilemma. It's what's called in education sometimes a disorienting dilemma. You have to become disoriented. I don't know why I'm doing this. I don't get it. It doesn't make sense. Well, we have glimmers when it makes sense, but the bottom line is why. And then the energy of bodhicitta pulling you, the energy of awakening pulling you, it's not even you. Somehow you're cooperating with something that you don't even know its shape or form. And so, you know, the motivation is also a part of it. Why do I do this? And there are short-term motivations that we sort of have to generate before they also get blown away by the wind. You know, I think the first motivation for many of us is, I'm such a mess, I would like to be a better person. And, well, that fails. Zen doesn't appear to turn us. It does, you know, as we were saying the other day, we do get more compassionate, more wise, we get better at sitting and all that stuff. That really happens. But not what we were looking for. I'm still me. Oh, shit. Really? I wake up in the morning? Yep. Same person. So that's not it. So then the next motivation for many of us is saving all beings. You know, we get that drummed into us, and we hear about the terrible tragedies of the world. And that's really important, too. I can't even stress how important it is to touch into the division in our own hearts and to work with healing that, so that the world will find some healing. It's not a cause-effect thing, but you know what I'm saying. And then there is a point in practice that many of us eventually reach, some of us earlier than others, where none of the motivations work. And we just do it anyway. Yeah. So wherever we are, it's not really a straight-line trajectory, because different reasons will keep popping up, and all of them are valid. And this is your root question. If the nature of the wind is permanent and it pervades everywhere, why do I have to fan myself? Mm-hmm. It's just the same question. So great. Mm-hmm. And you can't answer it. But you can be here right now asking the question and articulating it.
Yeah. What's with the deer you make out to be a horse? I don't get it. There are two things at the beginning that I didn't get. That's the first. What's the second line?
Oh, it's similar.
Digging earth that becomes gold.
Yeah.
So the first says making it out to be, and the second says it turns into. And then from later on, we realize these are good things, I think. Isn't that where the verse goes? thunder and lightning in your tongue. And, so I didn't know it was a good thing to look at a deer and make it out to be a horse.
Yay!
I like it, but I'm surprised. Isn't a deer a deer?
Oh, a doe is a deer. I mean, let's face it. Well, but seriously, David has a response for you.
So these are stories and writings from a very different culture than ours. And part of our work as students is dreaming in. And I love that Doe a Deer came. and we laugh. And there's something... don't worry too much about what you don't understand, unless you really don't understand.
I guess I trust that there is something to understand there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Otherwise it wouldn't be part of the case.
Yeah.
And that part seems least familiar somehow, least like all the other things in the superbook.
Well, and you'll keep encountering these things as the Dharma treasure reveals itself to you.
Right.
Believe me, there's all this stuff where you go, what?
Yeah.
Huh? That doesn't make sense.
And sometimes the culture, I mean, it turns out that, you know, if you're a ghost clinging to bushes and grasses, those are familiar tropes. Once you're in this world, that bushes and grasses are delusions or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But I didn't know whether deer and horses have a particular trait that anybody knows about.
There's an opportunity here, though, whether they do or not.
Yeah.
So we could get, we can investigate this in a scholarly way.
Yeah, no, but
we absolutely can, and that's great to do, and thank goodness for the scholars. We really depend on them a lot. And I'm most interested in your moment of, wait a minute, what's that? Right? Which really legitimately rose up for you in a beautiful way that you now shared with us. And you're not alone again. Like Caden, you're not the only one in the room probably who wondered. And it's in Zen, weirdly, not in Zen scholarship, that's a different thing, but in Zen practice, we really value that moment of wondering, or the lifetime of wondering, what is this? What is this? And I would almost encourage you to take a step back, and you know, because this, I'm suspecting this is not the only thing in your life that makes you have that reaction. Is that true?
Actually, this is it.
That's why it's so important.
That's why I've got it down, and it's just the deer, the horses.
Once I get that
last thing.
I want to bullshit my way into some answer that horses in China were more valuable than deer. But not you see why that wouldn't, then it would shut down the wonder.
Right.
And so almost taking it's like when we watch our thoughts, those of us who do the practice of watching thoughts, or in Shikantaza, that's part of it, just seeing thoughts as thoughts and not getting involved with the content. Seeing the wonder as wonder and really, really valuing it.
Yeah. Thank you.
It sounds like, I mean, it does make me think of the creative aspect of life, I guess, and of Zen, right?
It's
not just tuning into something that's already there.
Mm. Yeah.
You are making it up as you go along.
It's called life.
And it's new and fresh every time. It's what a great way of
that
being.
Voice.
Great. Thanks, Will.
Thank
you. What came up for me, well, first I'm going to say, a lot of these koans, when I first hear them, are extremely boring. I'm just like,
what?
There's a lot of listening required here.
And so the
point about noticing wonder and respecting it or appreciating it really resonated with me because of that. Because in each story there does seem to be one thread that really resonates with me, whereas the rest is just like
And she rolled her eyes.
Like I'm reading the beginning of a question on a test or something. But what came up for me listening to these couple Dharma dialogues, Dharma dialogues based on right and wrong, was something I heard about relationships, advice about relationships from, I guess, like a Buddhist perspective, but like, and that I think for me is now becoming a metaphor for understanding myself and the values that I place on myself. But in, I've certainly had this experience in relationship, and I'm sure a lot of people have, where I get locked into being right and the other person is the enemy, and it's just ego and needing to be in its place, needing to be, to demonstrate its authority. And if you can just let go of the two battling egos and say, hey, we're both on the same side against this thing that we've encountered, this issue in our relationship, then you can actually move forward. And I think I'm starting to understand my battle with right and wrong in within myself in a similar way. I spend so much time trying to decide whether I'm good or bad, right or wrong, and I'm going nowhere with it. And I don't think it really, it just doesn't matter, I guess. Right. Is the message. And to just see the whole picture and see the battle as the problem itself.
And I appreciate that we want to take sides, and seeing how we do that, and relationships are a wonderful practice that way. Every bit as good as sitting on the cushion in some way, and seeing that's what we do inside. And I think there's some point where we begin to suspect that there's no end to the battle. Like when you're noticing, and we have to notice that in ourselves. Well, as long as I think if I work a little harder, you know, then at some point we realize there's no way out here.
The finger trap.
And then we step back. One teacher talks about ABC, a bigger container. And we go, oh, that's just me fighting with me. And I don't even have to fight with fighting with me, because that's just another elaboration of the fight. Yeah. I'll get rid of this fight. Gosh darn it. Good. Well, so then we notice that. And then we really try to get rid of that and fight that. Mm-hmm. And eventually we fail.
And so you have that to look forward to.
Yeah. And as we fail enough, we begin, oh. Maybe I don't even have to fight the fighting of the fighting of the fighting. And then we take a breath. Ah, nice to be here this morning.
This particular koan appears earlier in our koan curriculum in the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection. It's the same koan, but has different commentaries, different poems, mm-hmm. different introduction. There are no deers or horses, as far as I know. But the guy who collected that collection just keeps interpolating all through it. A mistake. So, right, a mistake. Shredo says, wrong, oh, a mistake. And you can kind of feel the big container that David was just talking about in that. If everything has to be a mistake, because we don't want to limit things, and yet we do.
You know, I would add too that there's some kind of disorganizing that happens in Sesshin. I don't understand why. There's this mystery about just being in the container, and some of us are remarkably resourceful with our brains. And so we actually can hold it together for a long time and get some sort of story to glue onto about, you know, how I'm making it and what I'm doing and who I am, and we make it through a Sesshin. But, you know, you keep coming back, and eventually that whatever that is that we think we need disorganizes in some way and is somehow undermined. And that, for me, great fear in that. Oh my God, I'm totally disorganizing. Now I look forward to it. Like, oh, I don't remember what I'm supposed to do now. And it becomes this like little exciting moment. And so we get familiar with the disorganizing. And that becomes okay. And part of the relief, actually. And, you know, all these contradictions and confusions and everything in the beauty of this Zen Dharma where, you know, oh, I think I get it wrong, is a useful thing. You know? And so is right. You know, this all the... And it is something that we can't do. It's like Sesshin works on us. And yet we have to be here. We have to show up. We have to do it. But we can't make this happen. Just Sesshin happening to us. It's something we can have faith in. Our own disorganization.
And I just want to say that if that doesn't appeal to you, that's okay. You know, this is, because it's lifetime work, the amount of disorganization we can bear is unique to each one of us and unique to each one of us at each moment. Right? Yeah. So, because I'm thinking about all the times over the last 40 years that I've become deeply disorganized at the Sesshin. And then all the ways that I came up with to protect myself from that, which were all, I mean, talk about being creative. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. I wrote a 12-verse country and western song about Zazen early on. It preoccupied me for a whole evening. And I ended up staying late. And I remember staying up late, you know, beyond, because I just had to finish my song. It wasn't until the next morning when I was, like, doing the bus meditation. What did I do? And I talked to my teacher about it and told him. And he said, that protected you for a while. But it's not going to protect you forever. You know, how many more verses? Actually, tie in. Yeah.
Can you sing us a song?
Well, just the only thing I remember, that was like 35 years ago. We do Zazen, we do Zazen, with a moo and a hoo and a counting to 10. You wouldn't know me if you'd known me then, and each day is a fine day now that I do Zazen.
She really did. This wasn't good.
I'm blushing.
I actually didn't have any. The deer horse thing actually really resonated with me, and in a weird way, it made perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And I can talk about it, but I don't want to stifle your lunch.
Take away your treasure.
I'm sure your answer isn't good enough for me.
Okay.
Oh man.
In the real world out there, I have a job that involves making opinions and having views and making discriminations, which has made being in here really interesting, and that's the wall I'm up against, is how do I, after trying to put everything into Mu here, how do I go out there and start splitting everything up again? I was taking the sutras rather personally this morning. And what I love about it, as soon as I heard that verse, it didn't click with me yesterday, but it clicked with me today, that who needs to call a deer or a horse or a deer or a horse, their names. Their names we apply, their discriminations. Yeah, it's a quadruped, even that's a discrimination. It is what it is. And you can call it anything you want. And then the other half of that is picking up the dirt and seeing gold. Well, I've had, you know, we've all had that experience, hopefully here or elsewhere, where you're looking at something and it's, you know... Actually, you've got really interesting feet. At your feet. This isn't, you know... But I've just been struck... There's Mu there. That's all I can say. There's just... And other things that I've been seeing and experiences I've been having here and elsewhere. There's gold there. That's all I'm saying.
In that
dirt. So, that view.
Thank you.
I've overcome my usual reticence in China.
Your usual what?
Reticence.
Oh, reticence.
China. I also had something came up for me with the deer and.
the real teaching has occurred here.
Thanks, Will.
Some people know I love to go backpacking in the New England woods, and several times I've been lucky enough to encounter a moose, which is, you know, our most amazing northeastern animal, the largest one. And a couple of times, you know, I've heard it coming through the bushes, snapping all kinds of branches, and I've known when it appeared, oh, there's the moose. But twice I've turned a corner on a trail, and there's been this animal blocking the trail, and I looked at it and I said, why is there a horse way up there? How did we get on top of this mountain? And then I looked again, and I said, oh, it's a moose. And so for me, this is just how our minds work.
Yeah.
We see something, and we think, oh, horse. And then, you know, in this case, a second layer. Oh, no, of course, it's a moose. But then I try to be aware of how often in my life I think I'm looking at a horse. And then maybe it's a moose.
Yeah.
My partner does something, and I think, oh, she doesn't love me anymore. She's getting ready to leave me. You know, but no, it turns out that this was something completely different.
Yeah.
And so for me, this comes up as a story about my own mind and my own tendency to turn one thing into another. Mm-hmm. And horses into moose and moose into horses, and both into two. Yeah.
Thank you. And right into wrong. And how certain I am when I think I'm right that I am right. And how certain I am when I think usually someone else is wrong. that they're wrong, and that invitation, right, to look again, so not necessarily to dismiss our, you know, we don't have to struggle with it. I'm seeing this as right or this as wrong, but to look again and maybe have a touch of humility, a touch of honesty. Really, I am not actually 100% sure.
So from what I understand, I've been carrying out Jenny's instructions badly and cooking everything poorly. We should have potato chips for dinner.
Only if that little boy shows up.
It's funny because after what Will said about the horse and deer, it made me think of something entirely different. In Japanese, one of the words for stupid is baka. Mm. Strangely enough, the characters for that, the Chinese characters, are horse and deer.
Oh.
And no one has ever been able to explain to me why that's true. Mm. And at least in modern Chinese, horse and deer don't go together. Like, that doesn't make a word. They're just two different characters. So I'm sitting there going, you know, I wonder, way back when, there was some reason, and it's a stupid thing that, you know, it's like, you did something dumb, you confused them, you know, and now I'm trying to figure out. So we need to find that scholar who can explain that to me, because that's right. I mean, that's for weeks.
I know how to contact him. Seriously, I know somebody who's really into that, but anyway.
And so I want to say one thing, that each one of us here is a teacher. Mm-hmm. And when you come forward with whatever you have, even if all you've got is a silly question, right? If it's really a question, right? Then that is the entry point for the Dharma. You might not appreciate what you have. You might think confusion isn't good, whatever it is, but it's such a gift to the world when we come forward with our great heartbreak, or our real puzzlement. I'm really stuck. I remember going into my teacher once, sort of in the place similar to what Caden was talking about, and just so upset. And he listened and smiled and bowed to me. And as I was going out of the room, I thought, I think I just presented myself. He was quite pleased with me. As I was there in my, I don't get it, I'll never get it. And really seeing that you are presenting yourself at every moment, and this is the greatest gift you have to give. Your stuckness, your stubbornness, your disruptive, you know, your whatever. This is the treasure, and I so love these Dharma dialogues, all these associations, all of these questions. Each person fully, completely presenting the Dharma.
Shall we sit for 1 minute?
Yeah, so we'll...